Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Anybody who lives near the southern border of the United States in Southern California, Arizona, Texas, knows well that the border zone has been transformed in recent years, and if you're not familiar with it, visiting it can be quite a disturbing experience, even as a American citizen, and in my case, as a white person. Traveling in that area can be rather unnerving. One feature, of course, is the Border Patrol, increasingly militarized part of the American state apparatus, has sort of claimed the zone as its own, and there are stops featured along the interstate highways of dubious legality, wherein you pull up and one of these fellows leans in and asks you if you're an American citizen, and it's not altogether clear if they have the right to do so. And as they're having this conversation with you, dogs will go sniffing around your vehicle, and presumably if they respond, they therefore have the quote-unquote right to dig further into your business. As I mentioned, this, the legality or constitutionality of this is highly questionable, and indeed one of my favorite subgenres of YouTube videos involves the successful navigation of the space without giving these gentlemen any information. It can be quite admirable seeing the way that people navigate this zone, and again, this is largely white people who are American citizens. For people who are not white and who are not American citizens, it can be an extremely harrowing and indeed devastating experience. So on the one hand, the border is a very brutal place to see the current mechanisms of American power in the age of terrorism and the militarization of the police and other state forces. But it's also a very weird kind of existential space that's opened up and that crisscrosses and indeed strands many people. And the effect of this new border logic on folks, and particularly people of Mexican descent, undocumented workers, people who have been raised in particular in the United States but find themselves deported for various reasons, can often get stuck, literally, in this border zone. And this is the subject of a new documentary called Exile Nation, The Plastic People, by our guest today, directed by our guest today, Charles Shaw, and we'll be talking about this and other matters with Mr. Shaw. It's a great, wonderful documentary, very unnerving, but also very intimate and inspiring in terms of seeing how people try to navigate extremely difficult situations and forcing us all to really recognize what is at stake in our current regime of power. So I look forward to talking with Charles about this very much. He's, in addition to being a documentary filmmaker, he's a journalist and author, event producer with a very interesting history of his own in terms of dealing with state power, and we'll be getting to some of that. But before we bring Charles on, let's see if our co-host is around. Maja, are you there? Well, it looks like Maja has not made it today, so we'll see if she dials in. She can just pop in later. So without further ado, let's bring on our guest today, Charles Shaw. Charles, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
No problem, and thank you for having me back again. It's good to hear your voice, Eric.
Yeah. No, and I really, really loved the documentary. I mean, there's a lot of things to say about it. We'll want to talk about it for a bit here, but just right off the bat, one of the things that I really liked is that, you know, even for people who get interested in these issues, there's a tendency sometimes to get so involved in the kind of the politics, the sort of general politics of the situation, you know, understanding the changing nature of the border patrol, of immigration, these enormous fights over the status of immigrants that are going on. There's so much, you know, there's elements of racism, there's elements of economic concern, and these issues can become very abstract. And while you point to this zone and some of the complexities of it, you also tell a very personal story in terms of individuals. Both people are trying to help folks, you know, navigate this horrible zone, and in particular people who get essentially stuck in this zone. And one thing I didn't mention that is really remarkable is you throw light on a certain category of individuals that I have to say that while I knew existed in principle, I had never really considered as a particularly vulnerable subgroup in this whole political dynamic. And what I'm talking about here is, of course, undocumented Mexicans or Mexican Americans who grow up in the States, maybe live essentially their whole lives in the United States. Their families are here, they're Americans, they speak like Americans, they have American experiences and cultural contexts, and then for various reasons, they get deported because they're undocumented, and they wind up in Tijuana, kicked off of a bus, nowhere to go, no money, no ID, no social context, no family networks, and they're essentially stranded in this, you know, very destitute, impoverished, and difficult border zone. And it's really, again, like, it's remarkable in these stories, even as someone who's paid a lot of attention to these issues. I'm really concerned with borders. I'm concerned with the status of marginal people as they're moved around in our globalized, freaked out society. I never really thought about the particular existential and political conundrum that these folks fall into. So I'm really curious in your story, in your engagement with politics and issues of exile, what led you to sort of stumble upon and become fascinated with this particular category of folks and their, you know, unusually painful situation?
Well, I think he used the perfect word, which is stumble upon. And that was really how it all happened. Essentially, I had done an oral history of the drug war prior to this. And that's where I had met Chris Bava, who's the lead of the film and the ostensible narrator. And while I was in Tijuana in late 2010, filming a series of interviews with people who had various experiences with the drug war and the criminal justice system, about halfway through the interview, you know, I had asked Chris to talk about why he was in Tijuana and how his life had changed since he had been there. He was down there going through Ibogaine therapy for a relapse of a drug addiction. And, you know, Ibogaine's not legal in the United States, but it is legal in Mexico. And so a lot of people go across the border to Tijuana, where there's a kind of a burgeoning underground community. And he just starts telling me about all of these Americans, as he put it, that are stranded in Tijuana, essentially living in the sewers and streets. And he, you know, told me pretty much everything that you laid out when you were introducing the topic about where they had grown up. And the only distinction I would make is that, yes, they're undocumented in various capacities, but they are immigrants. They aren't migrant workers, you know, and there is two very distinct groups. And unfortunately, both policymakers and the media, and then by extension, the public, only has this idea of, you know, the illegal alien. They don't understand that millions of Mexicans came here essentially at our invitation after we passed NAFTA and said, please come for a better life. The borders are open. And so these millions of Mexicans came here for a better life right around the same time that the same NAFTA policies kicked all of these farmers and peasants off of their land all across Mexico as they kind of undid this collectivization that the PRI had implemented over kind of 100 years. You know, the whole Pancho Villa revolution was based on giving land back to the peasants. NAFTA totally undid that. It gave it to the corporations and the drug lords. So all those dislocated peasants and poor people either went to Mexico City, which is now the largest city in the world, or they crossed the border and came north. A few million of them stayed at the border and became part of the Maquiladora network, which is the sweatshops. And that was kind of a, you know, I wouldn't say a good arrangement, but it was a replacement arrangement for what they had. And they were making decent money for a while, and then 9/11 happened, and 9/11 changed everything. And so they slammed the border shut after 9/11, and they just started deporting people. So you had the problem of migrants that would come across the border, work at a slaughterhouse or a farm or what have you, and then they would remit their money back to Mexico. And that's the big thorn in the side of the government. That's what they really don't want. It benefits the corporations, and it's the second largest source of revenue for Mexico behind drug profits. But the United States doesn't like it because all that money is going out of the country. So the agenda is really against these migrant workers. However, the immigrants are the ones that also suffer, and they tend to be the ones that suffer the most. If a migrant worker gets rounded up by ICE at a farm or a slaughterhouse, they're deported back. The government buys them a bus ticket, and they go home to their family.
Well, I just want to stop a second just to define what ICE is, because that was something I knew about the way that the immigration and what used to be called the Immigration Naturalization Services had transformed, but you really show how much that the transformation of this body that is at least in principle devoted to helping immigrants naturalize into the United States has become essentially a militarized function, and even the name of it has this kind of disturbing, you know, fearful quality. So just could you just tell us a little bit about that particular organization and how that's changed in the post 9/11 world?
Yes, absolutely. So INS, as you just explained, it was a social service agency meant to help people become citizens, to naturalize. And there was a kind of there really was never any true immigration policy with Mexico. We've never really had one. It's always been kind of a hostile relationship between us and Mexico. And, you know, in the 30s, they, quote, repatriated 2 million Mexicans back to Mexico, and half of them were already U.S. citizens. So there's already this acrimonious relationship going on. Reagan comes into power in the 80s, and he calls for this amnesty. And as part of the amnesty, people that had snuck in got to become naturalized. They got to get on the path to citizenship. And it also created a quota system. And there's a quota system that had been around for many years. And the long and short of it is that there was never more than 10,000 visas issued to Latin America. And that's all of Latin America, from Mexico down to the tip of Chile. So you have to imagine how many Mexicans actually got visas, and the only ones that would be the most educated and most affluent. So we never really had a policy, which is why in the film, Rinku Sen, who runs Color Lines magazine and the Applied Research Center, she says there's no, you know, everyone says get in line, wait your turn, but there's no line for Mexicans. Then NAFTA comes around, and suddenly they say, okay, it's not technically an open border, but it's an open border. And you can pass back and forth with little more than a driver's license. And one of the stories that one of our lead characters, Dragon, tells is the first time he was deported in the mid-90s, he crossed back the same day that his friends met him in Tijuana with his ID and took him right back over the border. That gives, you know, anti-immigration activists the chills when they hear that, but that's the way it used to be. So 9/11 happens, the border is slammed shut, and all of a sudden, first of all, Mexico pays more than the Middle East for what happened on 9/11, because the economic devastation of closing the border basically turned Tijuana into a ghost town, and all the other border towns like Laredo and Juarez and such, and opened it up for the drug lords. But there was also a massive reorganization in the government, and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security put everything on a defense security paradigm. And INS, Immigration Naturalization Services, was turned into Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And their job was no longer to naturalize citizens. It was to police and expel illegal immigrants. And they deported, you know, there was about 14,000 people deported from the United States the year before George Bush took office. By the time George Bush left, they were deporting about 200,000 a year. Barack Obama comes into office and within 2 years launches what's known as the Secure Communities Initiative, which essentially was a very clever way of linking the Immigration and Customs Enforcement database into local police forces. So that anytime there was any type of traffic stop or ID check, it was cross-checked against immigration, at which point deportation skyrocketed. And they have been running at about 800,000 a year for the last few years. So Obama deported more people in his first term than Bush did in two. And it hasn't slowed down, even with the passage of this, you know, DREAM Act, which they say stops, you know, they claim stops the problem that Plastic People highlights, which is, you know, young people that grew up in the United States being deported. But it's only if you are an affluent immigrant and you're already enrolled in a college and have graduated high school. Very few of these immigrants have that kind of affluence. And
yeah,
that,
you mentioned that the phrase plastic people, and I'd like to, you know, to have you define that, but also just to say that you know, again, we, you know, when we have these kinds of political discussions, it gets kind of abstract. There's large numbers. We talk about you know, changing policies and the incredible effects that they have, and how they're really beneath a lot of the things that we see on the surface of the media. But again, part of what's so wonderful about your documentary is that it's also about very specific, very real people. And the character Dragon you mentioned is a remarkable person who you met through Chris Bava. You know, very fortunately for you, Chris Bava, he's sort of a character, you know, an American who winds up in Tijuana for various reasons, and he's interested in photography, he's interested in the rough and tumble sides of Tijuana life, and he meets a lot of these fascinating characters leading very difficult lives, of which Dragon really pops out as one of the main characters in your documentary. And it's kind of interesting because initially you see him, he's a drug user, he's living in these terrible slum conditions, and you know as a watcher you might have certain ideas about him and his education level and his relationship to America. And then the more you hear from him, the more you talk with him, the more he unfolds. He speaks English wonderfully. He's a very sensitive, intelligent person, and you suddenly get a sense for this particular class of people, the plastic people. So where does that phrase come from, and how does Dragon help tell your story?
Plastic people, translated in Mexican Spanish, is los entes plásticos. And what it means is essentially that it's a double entendre. It means that they're fake, like Americans, plastic, but also that they're throwaway, they're disposable. And they are essentially the dispensable population in both Mexico and the United States. And when these people get deported, they're stripped of everything, ID, money, clothing, right down to just the shirt and pants and shoes on their back, and spit across the border, shook down by both U.S. and Mexican border agents, and deposited into the most dangerous ghetto in Tijuana, which is the operating zone for, you know, the Zeta cartel and Guzman's cartel. It's a exceptionally dangerous place, and it was the most brilliant decision I ever made in my life to go down there with a movie camera and try to capture it. These people are like ripped from their families. They're ripped from their jobs. It doesn't matter what their situation is, whether they're kids, whether, you know, they're in school, whether they have a job, they're instantly deported and they can't get back. And without the ability, you know, in Mexico, they have to have ID. That's this law. You have to have ID to be on the street, but they know who the plastic people are because they live in the street and they look like they live in the street. And they're not allowed to leave this little ghetto where the police and the cartels, you know, use them as easy fodder, as drug couriers, drug pushers, drug users, and ultimately prisoners. Because the criminal justice system, very loosely named oxymoron there in the Mexican system, is all about profit. So you can, no matter what your crime is, you can bail your way out. No matter what your sentence is, you can pay to get out. And so, you know, every day there's three or four raids through this little area, this little ghetto, and particularly down into the canal and the sewer drains. And they scoop them all up and take them all off to jail, and they look at what open cases they have, and they just put, you know, take out as many as they have open cases for. They pin the crimes on them and send them off to prison, and the rest they release back into the street, only to be picked up again, you know, the next time there's another raid. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And the most they can make is $5 or $10 a day. You know, if they can find some kind of hustle or have like an odd job or something. Most of them clean, cars. They would clean, you know, car windshields, and, you know, the opening of the film explains how that's how Chris Fava met most of them, going back and forth across the border. And then the police cracked down on the window cleaners, and suddenly they weren't allowed to clean windows anymore. So they're essentially starving. And their life expectancy drops to, you know, less than a year.
One of the things I also appreciate about it is, and I know you know, obviously you've done a lot of journalistic and documentary work about the drug war, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later in terms of the other things you've done and your concerns there. But one of the wonderful things about this documentary is that you include a sort of, you know, you shed light on the way that drugs function in the situation, both in terms of why, you know, individuals in the situation, you know, turn to drugs because there really is nothing else, and, you know, it's pervasive around them. It's the nature. It's the central currency of the world that they're in. But you don't make the film about, like, the drug problem or drug addiction. Drug problems, drug addiction, getting off of drugs, the challenges of getting off of drugs. I mean, that was, one of the moving parts of this, is that while we see Dragon as a drug user and you know, hiding from the cops and the whole, all the sort of game of that situation, we see him then have the opportunity to clean up, but then that is also difficult because he's still without much context, without many contacts, and it's also difficult. So there's a way in which drugs are not like a standalone subject or a topic unto themselves, but they're intimately woven into these issues of immigration, of the transformation of the border, and the rise of of drug power, violent drug power in Mexico. So, I'm kind of curious to hear you a little bit, because of all the work you've done on the drug war, is thinking about that side of it a little bit. Like, how are some of the political concerns that you've developed, you know, vis-a-vis the drug war, sort of, how do they play themselves out in this weird interzone?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I guess I can respond in short, first by kind of citing this book called A Mexica, and it's by a British journalist, Ed Villamy, who, you know, spent a lot of time all up and down the border zone. He calls it a whole separate culture, really, of this cross-border culture. And what he says is basically that globalization is the drug economy and the human trafficking economy. That's what it is. That's what free trade is. And that all of these, you know, all this neoliberal lingo about, you know, what they sold it to us as is, you know, just a facade. And so, you know, the story in America is that, the Mexicans are no good and they grow drugs and all of, you know, the world's supply of drugs comes right across our border and we have to protect ourselves from it. The reality is that it's the demand in America that drives it, and the fact that shipping it all up from Central and South America became too costly. And so it was just much easier for the Mexican cartels to take over when there was no other economy for them. See, NAFTA destroyed Mexico. It made a few oligarchs incredibly wealthy and pretty much devastated the rest of the population. And, you know, like I said, the two biggest sources of revenue are the drug economy, which is number one by far, and then remittances from the United States. So in the absence of it, in absence of true economic activity or in a real life, everybody pretty much has to decide to either leave or get involved with the cartels. There's a long story that didn't make it into the film about Dragon's family. And when he finally got deported after 9/11 and had to go back, he went to visit his father, and his father was living on his family land out in Nayarit, which is on the eastern side of Mexico from Tijuana and a little bit south. And his farm had been taken over by his uncles, who were working for one of the cartels, and had turned it into a meth lab. And, you know, Dragon was faced with the choice of either, like, working for the family business or leaving. So he chose to leave and go to Tijuana. And he was he became a champion Thai boxer. And that's how he made his money. His father ended up committing suicide, right, because it was too much for him. And this story is common all over Mexico. It's, you know, just endless tragedy as to what NAFTA did to that country. And then, you know, every bit of border, you know, militarization and every foot of fence that they build higher is all justified by this drug war, you know, these narco terrorists, as they call them. But, you know, the violence bleeds over in the States, you know, not nearly as much as they say. And not only that, but, you know, we're the cause of whatever violence is going on there. And if we, you know, weren't the indirect cause of it just by our demand for drugs, we became the direct cause of it with the Meridia Initiative, when we started shipping billions of dollars worth of arms and other support and aid to the federales, ostensibly, but we now later find that a lot of it went to the cartels, which essentially ratcheted up that whole drug war. And that started in 2005 with Felipe Calderon. And it wasn't, it was not an accident that a conservative government finally came in and seized power after 70-year rule by the PRI, which is, you know, the part of the Socialist Party that essentially became entrenched and essentially ossified. So, there is a lot that
this
makes sense.
This raises a lot of really interesting questions. So I want to talk more about the drug war and then some of your interests in drug culture in the States and some of the issues raised by it. But we got to take a break here.
Sure.
You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Charles Shaw, the director of a new documentary, Exile Nation, The Plastic People, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're talking with Charles Shaw about his documentary, Exile Nation, and about the politics of the drug war. I think it would be great to hear also a little bit about your earlier project and indeed your particular concern and avenue into your the problems raised by the drug war and your earlier work on it. What do you think? I mean, there's a lot of coverage about it. There's a lot of excellent investigative journalists journalism out there if you dig down for it. But what would you say is your particular angle or concern with illuminating the sort of dark reality of the drug war for us today?
Well, I think it all started really, if I had to be honest with myself, as a kind of way of defending myself. You know, I got into a very, very serious crack addiction in my 20s and early 30s, very early 30s, as a result of, extended chronic post-traumatic stress disorder from a lot of violence and a lot of really crazy stuff that went down in my life, all of which I chronicle in my book, Exile Nation, Drugs, Prisons, Politics, and Spirituality. And I started, I wrote that book as a way of kind of like going through a catharsis of coming to terms with, being a drug addict and then being a prisoner, going into the Illinois penitentiary system, dealing with police corruption. And at some point in the early part of my political awakening, I was writing for a radio show it was hosted by a guy named Kerry Harrison. It was called Reality Checks. And we were syndicated in 215 markets by 2000. And he had hired me to write scripts and research stories. And we had heard, this is like when Gary Webb had just released this whole Dark Alliance series and had finally connected the CIA to the crack epidemic. And when I heard about that, it just, I don't know, there was something about it that just, enraged me on so many levels, because here I was, labeled a drug addict, a crackhead by society, basically without any value or worth. I couldn't get a job. I couldn't advance myself, without being wildly creative, because I had this label and this criminal record. And then to find out that, my own government, or however I came to understand it differently later, wasn't my own government, but an aspect of our government, an official arm, even acting in an unofficial capacity, was behind the whole thing. And it just, man, did it get my goat, as they used to say. And so that started this like really deep compulsion to humanize the drug war and to humanize people like me, because there were so many people living in shame because of their experiences, and we're trying to cover up everything that had happened in their past. And we were an exile nation of people living in internal exile, living outside society in a kind of unofficial new Jim Crow apartheid, second-class citizenry. And I mean that literally, too. I'm not just speaking rhetorically. And, the great unknown is that 65 million people in this country can't pass a background check because of an arrest or a conviction. So it's a pretty pervasive problem. And I put out word after
I got a question for you about that, about the stigma. I mean, and again, it's not overt in your documentary, but one of the things that comes through is your profound sympathy for addicts, for the reasons that people use drugs, for the reasons that people get addicted to drugs, but also a sense of the, I don't want to say ordinariness of it, but that it's not a sign of some exotic other kind of person, and I think that's something that's really peculiar still, when in a lot of ways a lot of the problems that people get into, psychological problems, addictive patterns, compulsive patterns, we're coming to sort of naturalizing them. We see that there are problems with brain chemistry, there's problems with PTSD, there's a lot of reasons that people wind up being gambling addicts or sex addicts or compulsive liars, et cetera, et cetera. Nonetheless, despite that, despite the fact that drugs pervade our society and most societies on the planet, there's still this incredible stigma to being a drug user, sure, but particularly having been a drug addict, as if once you cross that line, you become like a different kind of person that can now be thought of in different ways. So there's still, it's sort of jarring. Like you're when you talk to Chris Baba in the documentary, here's this guy. He's a very artistic guy. He's very articulate. He's had a wild life. You know, he wrote up and down through all sorts of levels of criminality, but he's, you know, a rich character who talks about his own addiction and how it drove him, you know, to Mexico, to Ibogaine therapy, to getting his life back, which he clearly has, and then he ends up, you know, helping a lot of these other kinds of characters. It's like, it's a very complex world. People pass in and out of drug addiction the way they pass through many parts of their lives, and yet there is this extra stigma and something that you've experienced personally and to some degree still do. And I think it gives your work an interesting twist that you don't find in a lot of investigative journalism, where you might get the facts, you might get very penetrating insight, but you're also in some ways part of the story you're telling, even if the story you're telling is a big, large-scale political one. You have a personal investment and a personal response to these things that I think is really kind of remarkable. So how would you say, like, what has your experience having been an addict and going to prison and, you know, going sort of, you know, the full Monty, let's say, how has that changed your sense about what's at stake with the being a journalist, you know, being bringing these ideas into people, to making sure that people pay attention to these things, to telling these stories in a way that can hopefully make some kind of change?
The first thing that I would say is, I recommend that to everyone that will do it, to read this book called Intoxication, The Universal Drive for Mind-Altering Substances. And it's written by Ronald Siegel, who's a professor of medicine at University of California, Los Angeles. And he used to be Jimmy Carter's drug advisor. He was the guy who wrote initially saying that this epidemic of smokable cocaine was headed towards the United States in the late 70s, and that cocaine was highly addictive and dangerous. And he was poo-pooed by all the, you know, the medical community, who said that cocaine was harmless, just as a point of how dead on this guy is. So his book basically lays out a very, you know, easily digestible thesis that altering our consciousness constitutes our fourth primal drive behind, you know, food, rest, and procreation. And that we have evolved alongside animals for thousands of years, observing them altering their consciousness by eating fermented fruit and wild mushrooms and mimicking them, and then ultimately even going and harvesting mushrooms from their dung and everything. And we have as much of a need to get out of our state of consciousness as we do to do anything autonomically. And Jung was very articulate about saying that there is a need for transcendence and a need for ecstatic experience. And this ties directly into what Siegel says on a biological level. So that's the first thing, is that I always come from that point of view, that we should never be surprised when anybody wants to alter their consciousness, that people in terrible, depressing, anxiety-ridden, fearful situations will naturally gravitate towards something to take the edge off, and why shouldn't they? And likewise, people like to celebrate. People like to wind down. People like to wind up. I mean, it's part of every aspect of our life. And so the mainstream opinion is pornographic. I call it pipe porn or needle porn. They only want to know about the depravity. And that was a problem for me. What Hollywood and what the media loves the most is a reformed former bad boy or girl, you know, where they go through their bad stage, so everybody gets to watch them collapse publicly in front of billions of people, and everybody gets to feel better because they're not there. And then they bottom out, and then a few years later they come back and they have this huge comeback because they're humble and penitent and contrite and they toe the line. And I wasn't about to do any of that. That's not in my character. And what I wanted was to show the feistiness and the brilliance and the defiance and the humanity of all this cross-section of society that's been, you know, dismissed and discarded by the drug war. You have to, like, connect with people on a personal level, you know, and personal stories communicate so much more than throwing facts at people. You know, the irony, Eric, is that for as much as I could never get any traction, you know, doing all of this work about the drug war, as soon as I got done with the oral history project and walked away and started looking at the migration and issue and all of that, there was a year where it suddenly the drug war became fashionable and it went mainstream. And Eugene Jarecki's film won Sundance and Danny Glover's film got widespread acclaim and, you know, Michael Douglas's kid became a poster child for, you know, wrongful convictions. And all of this happened. A sea change that we had been predicting for years happened. And then in its wake came legalization of cannabis and stuff like that. So, you know, I do believe all of these tipping points are definitely possible. But here's the reason, though, why I think the stereotype persists. And it's really quite simple. And this used to be called a Marxist analysis, but it's really not. It's just common sense. But for capitalism and for this three-class structure of society to exist and to be, you know, successful and effective, at least for the ruling body, there needs to be an underclass. And there has to be some despised or, you know, surplus population class that they can, you know, point to and say, listen, you're better off than them. So this is what kept, you know, Jim Crow alive, this idea that poor whites were somehow better by virtue of their genetics than people that were of darker color but in the exact same political and economic situation as them. So this is what's kept, you know, the races divided and kept the classes apart, is this idea that, like, you know, you can always look downward. Well, after civil rights, it was no longer okay to look downward at someone's skin color, so you had to find other minorities and you had to find other reasons to discriminate. So they discriminated on the grounds of sexual orientation and lifestyle, and that became drug use. And your criminal background and all this other stuff. And so once again, this underclass perpetuates and it continually shifts. And immigrants are usually always part of this underclass.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things this makes me think of, you know, we're at such a weird, interesting, schizophrenic period in terms of shifting ideas of drug use and what is a drug and what, you know, all these sorts of issues, particularly around the legalization or the steps towards legalization or at least decriminalization of cannabis. And so on the one hand, you see more and more mainstream media representations and just even just among ordinary people, a sort of a really profound shift about, you know, hey, maybe this isn't so bad. You know, actually my brother does it, or I did it when I was a kid, or what's the problem? And really, you know, and we start to, we're really shifting rather rapidly in kind of a remarkable way, not unlike, let's say, the sea change in opinions around gay marriage, for example, where, you know, 15 years ago it was hard to imagine anybody in the mainstream caring, and now it's almost there. It's almost just kind of installed, except for sort of a you know, conservative Christian fringe for a lot of people. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but in some sense it's been really remarkable. And something like that is happening with cannabis. And yet, at the same time, the drug laws allow the continued re-inscription of this underclass, particularly African Americans and Mexican Americans and immigrants, who use cannabis or deal cannabis on some level. And the engine of the quote-unquote justice system continues to, like, reinscribe the sense that this is the legitimate underclass, the criminal. This is how we make the underclass into a criminal underclass, is through the application of cannabis laws, even as, you know, white kids and, you know, groovy college kids in Colorado are, you know, starting businesses based on cannabis, and there's this kind of lightening of the load. So it's a very weird kind of schizophrenic time. What do you see are the sort of most kind of positive avenues of change? Like where is the pivot, so to speak, to really shift and transform our relationship to drug use, including the way in which it has been used so far or recently? I'm in a not good zone on my cell phone. Such is life in our grungy media age.
Right. Well, hey, the answer to your question is twofold, but most of it is not what you're probably going to expect. From my perspective, the positives are all the advancements that have been made and the legitimization that's happened with psychedelic medicine. And I think that's really going to be the place where we derive the most benefit, and cannabis is a huge part of that. And also, you know, everyone's going to be able to smoke their weed. So, yay. The bad news, it's not going to go down like all of these ganja barons think. And I can guarantee you this. The people that are running the show are not going to make the same mistake again that they made with the dot-com revolution. They are not going to empower a bunch of progressive-minded people with billions of dollars. They are going to do what they've done with medical cannabis, and they're going to systematically bust every grower from San Diego to Bellingham, seize their land, seize their assets, because they need to, and they're completely desperate. And then they're going to turn that over to big corporations. And, you know, the major tobacco producers have already bought in excess of 50,000 acres up in the Mendo and Humboldt counties. Monsanto's patented a Terminator cannabis seed. So in short order, you know, it took basically 15 years for the American farming system and America, North America in general, to be completely contaminated with GMOs. It'll take less than that probably to go through the cannabis supply. And man, that's a major bummer. And I hate to be the one to have to say that, but that's what's going on. So that's the dark side of legalization.
Yeah, so many issues are raised, and I can totally see the scenario you're outlining as well, or some mixture of a kind of a much more pitched battle than people might expect between people who are trying to sort of keep the progressive side of the culture alive in the face of this, what will be an extraordinarily, you know, rapid and high dollar transformation of the economy. But I want to ask you another question on this, which touches a little bit on a talk I saw you give at the Breaking Convention in Los Angeles in London this summer. Which is, it to some extent, do you feel that the part of the problem, and maybe not directly in terms of the power of capitalism, but part of the problem lies in the way in which the sort of the counterculture that identifies itself with cannabis, with psychedelics to some degree, but in some ways that culture is almost too naive to fight the political battle that needs to be fought in order to keep these things from just becoming part and parcel of, you know, pharmaceutical industry and big commodity corporations. That in a way there's something that, quote unquote, we haven't done, and indeed have almost kind of lost vis-a-vis the politics of consciousness, the politics of the situation surrounding these in many ways very positive substances.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the more shocking things that I came to learn over time. And I mean, I guess to answer the question, you have to start at the point of quote unquote awakening or transformation that so many people have when they cross over into the alternative culture, the counterculture. And that's a very liberating experience for people. And it often involves, you know, psychedelic and other visionary substances. They have their awakening. That's a good thing. And it's legit. It's real. Unfortunately, what happens is that, and I came to see that they become highly, and we became highly susceptible to all kinds of programming in this state. And the easiest way to describe it is to say that very few people in the counterculture, the New Age world, whatever you want to call it these days, ever stop to really question where their beliefs came from. They all seem to think that they're all, you know, ancient and, you know, proven over time, but they don't really sit back and go, like, where did this come from? You know, there isn't a Bible or a Quran or a Torah that we can point to, but we just take all of this stuff on faith. And it was the taking it on faith that troubled me. I had an experience with an ex-partner whose parents were Sitchinites. You know, they were obsessed with Zachariah Sitchin. And they took everything that he said as gospel. And they would defend any criticism about him with the same type of vehemence and circular logic that evangelical Christians would defend their beliefs. And I started seeing this incredible similarity between the New Age culture and the evangelical Christian culture. I mean, they both essentially believe in divine beings. In New Age, they believe in, you know, aliens. And, you know, evangelicals believe in angels. They believe in demons or, you know, dark energy, archons, parasites, whatever you want to call it. The evangelicals believe in the rapture. New Agers believe in the ascension. One after another, these things like all lined up parallel, and I started, it fit in the same slot, and then, oh my gosh, it all dawned on me. I read this awesome, amazing book by a xenoarchaeologist named Jason Colavito. He's a professor in Buffalo, and his book is called H.P. Lovecraft and the Cult of the Alien Gods. H.P. Lovecraft and the Alternative Pseudo-History of America, or something like that. And what he does is he basically goes and as like an archaeologist, he goes and tracks all the sources of all of this, you know, lore in our culture, and they all track back to basically three main sources: H.P. Lovecraft's fiction, Madame Blavatsky's writings, and Charles Fort. From those three, they extrapolated this entire cosmology of Atlantis and aliens and Pleiadians and Andromedans. And I later came to find that based on all the MKUltra studies, you know, all the psychological profiling that went on in the post-war era with all that Bernays-based psychology of manipulation and consumption and such, and all the manipulation and studies into the super soldiers and isolating compounds and such, MKUltra was a complete categorical disaster as far as creating a super soldier, but it was really good at two things. One, it created a huge stockpile of LSD, and they found that the LSD turned people into spiritual or religious, people who have spiritual or religious experiences and epiphanies, and also they were pacifists. You know, all of the servicemen didn't want to go fight in Vietnam after taking LSD in the tests. They also amassed a gigantic, like, database of psychological profiling. And they were able to parse out, essentially, that what happened with science and rationalism in the post-war era is that we lost one of the three main foundations of society that holds us together, which is, you know, war, religion, and trade or currency, wealth, right? And so the religion part we lost because science took away all of the miracles and mysteries of religion. But that natural urge that we have to transcend, that God urge that Jung talked about, was still in us and needed something. And right. They found... Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
No, I was just going to say we actually just need to wrap it up, but I think what we're coming down to, I just want to make explicit about your work, and it's in the documentary as well, so once you acknowledge the natural aspect of this desire for transcendence, that is part of our lives, and we have to take responsibility for it, and we have to be aware that it too is political. It too is something that we need to be critical about without denying, without pretending that it's going to solve all our problems, but also without believing that we can understand a world without this drive towards intoxication, towards God, transcendence, and that when you have to factor that in to understand what's going on. But that it's about all we have time for, and I want to give you a moment to let people find out more about you. So is there a website? Is there other stuff you're doing right now?
Yes, absolutely. People can go to exilenation.org. That's where my books and all my videos and films are. And I just released a new short film this morning called Requiem for a Borderless World. And it's shot all over the world at militarized borders.
Great. Well, Charles, thanks so much for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Eric. I really appreciate it.
All right. From me to all you out there, keep your minds open.